funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the meaning of macho in the modern world? And are traditions that elevate the interests of men ahead of women bound for evolution, if not extinction? About 4 out of every 5 jobs lost in the United States and Europe since last November were held by males. By the end of the year, some experts estimate the recession will leave as many as 28 million men jobless worldwide. So what do those alarming numbers say about the way we run things and have run things until now? And do these changes signal a new world order? Rehan Salam is a fellow at the New America Foundation and has just published an article called The Death of Macho for the July-August issue of Foreign Policy magazine. Rehan, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much for having me, Chris.
We should try first, I guess, to get a handle on what you mean by macho. You call it a state of mind. Will you explain that?
Sure. I think that it's an attitude toward risk-taking that actually has a lot of valuable qualities but has some downsides as well. So, for example, you know, men have traditionally demonstrated their prowess. They've demonstrated, you know, how they can better other men, how they can dominate others, how they can, you know, make a mark in the world by taking big risks and, you know, bringing home the mammoth meat by being hunters. And that economic behavior has, again, helped spur tremendous entrepreneurial growth. But when it gets pathological, when it gets out of hand, it's been really destructive.
And part of the reason for that is that many men are out of work right now is that a lot of these bubble jobs were in these risk-taking areas in the financial sector and then also in male-dominated sectors like construction.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting part of what's been happening over the last couple of years. Basically, you had the labor market position of working-class men deteriorate for a long period of time in America, and the housing boom was a way that working-class guys, guys who didn't always finish high school and who didn't make it to college, were able to get actually pretty decent wages. In the construction sector, wages tended to be in the neighborhood of about $800 a week. And so, you know, lots of men were able to keep their families afloat making those wages. But now that the, you know, housing construction has totally ended for all intents and purposes, that's going to be a real problem that's going to cause serious dislocation.
So is salary disparity even in other industries part of the reason? In other words, higher paid employees, in many cases men, are the first to go, even if people are doing the same job?
Yeah, I mean, that's complicated because when you're looking at the gap, the pay gap between women and men, we've actually seen that close, even though it still persists. And you've seen it close, particularly when you're looking at entry-level folks. When you're looking at, you know, young women and men just entering the labor market, that pay gap is very narrow. But what happens is that women have tended to take on a lot of those added economic burdens involved in raising children, taking care of adult parents, for example, and that leads to interruptions in your labor force participation. And those interruptions make it harder for you to get all of those raises and harder for you to get the supervisory authority that you get when you tend to stay in place for a longer period of time. So that's something that's been traditionally very unfair towards women and that I think we're going to see change.
How do outsourced jobs tend to affect the male segment of the U.S. workforce?
That's a really interesting question. Basically, you know, the question is, what jobs can you outsource? And so far, the jobs that we've been able to outsource have been manufacturing jobs. You know, you can make a widget pretty much anywhere and ship it as long as, you know, the cost of energy is sufficiently low that you can afford to do that. And so, you know, you've seen manufacturing workers get the heaviest squeeze during this period of globalization. Whereas other jobs, for example, school teachers, those are jobs that, you know, are a lot harder to do on a long-distance basis. And as you were alluding to earlier on, the thing about women in this economy has been that they tend to be concentrated in those sectors that are harder to move, that are non-tradable sectors, and they also tend to be in sectors that are financed by government, like healthcare and education. So, you know, as long as government keeps paying the bills, those jobs stay in place.
And that's a really interesting component of the article, I think, Rehan. We've talked a lot about shovel-ready stimulus projects in the current recession, but the truth is they don't represent the bulk of new spending right now.
Yeah, that's very true. Basically, the bulk of the stimulus spending, for example, came in the form of maintaining social service programs. One thing that's been very frustrating for people with this economy is that, you know, you have rules in 49 of the 50 states that say you have to balance your state budget. On the other hand, you have the federal government that's borrowing in order to prime the pump of the economy. So you have the states and the feds working at odds with each other. And the stimulus was basically propping up about half of that state spending that's going to have to go as tax receipts decline. So you have this very, very funny situation where, you know, you kind of give with one hand and you take away with the other.
Rehan Salam is my guest. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and has published a piece for the July-August issue of Foreign Policy magazine called The Death of Macho. We've heard for several years now that the proportion of men with college degrees is falling in comparison with women in this country. And for a while, I think a lot of us read that as a positive step for women who in the past had had less formal education. Now, though, we're seeing a significant imbalance in the other direction.
Yeah, it's a very significant imbalance, in part because it starts early. You see boys start to fall behind girls now around the time you get to middle school. And then you have lots of boys dropping out of high school. And, you know, the phenomenon of the high school dropout rate in our country is really disturbing because the returns to finishing high school or to getting a college degree are so great. Yet despite that fact, you see huge numbers of people drop out. So clearly there's some non-economic driver of this phenomenon, and it's definitely a heavily male phenomenon. And so what that means is that, you know, you have more girls graduating from high school. You have more girls who are going to college and finishing college. Then you have more girls increasingly going into the professions that require advanced degrees, like medicine and the law.
Have we done so much encouraging of girls in school that we've sort of made boys in at-risk areas think that education is something that girls do?
That's thorny. I would say that encouraging girls to do well is a wonderful thing, and we should do more of it rather than less. On the other hand, I do think it's possible that single-sex education for boys, particularly when they're in that sensitive age, you know, from, you know, when they start school to around 15, 16, might be actually a better way to go. But frankly, there's no conclusive evidence about this. It's hard to say. But I think that, you know, there are some indications that, you know, as you suggest, boys really do identify academic success with girls. And that makes it less appealing to them, particularly those boys who are, you know, average or below average in terms of their proclivity towards academic performance.
Obviously, you've had to do a great deal of research and pull together a lot of different interviews in order to create this piece that you've put in Foreign Policy. Are you seeing evidence in the people that you talk to that there are a significant number of Americans who sort of hold men particularly responsible for the current state of the economy?
You know, I don't really think that people have seen the downturn here through a gender lens. And I think that that's why the article spends a lot of time looking at this in a global context. For example, your listeners are all aware of the tremendous upsurge that happened in Iran, with huge numbers of people taking to the streets in protest at what they saw as a stolen election. But what's interesting about that is, remember, this is a pretty conservative Islamic society, and a lot of those folks who took to the streets were women. And they were women who took to the streets because, as in the United States, they tended to have much higher rates of educational attainment than men, yet in Iran, they were excluded from huge swaths of the economy. Women are not allowed to take a lot of senior jobs in the economy. They're just really locked out of the power structure. And so that's built up a lot of resentment, and it led to that upheaval that we saw to some degree. But again, you know, people don't always see it through that lens of gender.
Yeah, how do you see this phenomenon playing out if it continues this way, that men are losing 80% of the jobs that are lost in places in the world where there really isn't a lot of gender equity? Is it worse there? Are women actually more at risk as men start to realize that they're losing out?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the thing. I think of it as the basis for male power has traditionally rested on this substance of men being the breadwinners. But as that substance goes away, then it just becomes the raw exercise of power of keeping women down just so you could keep men up. And that creates a very unstable situation, like the situation that you see in Iran. So, you know, for example, people always talk about how the French Revolution happened despite the fact that that was a period of reform in late 18th century France. So if it was a period of reform and opening up, why did you have a revolution? Well, because people got a taste of how things could be a little different. And when they got a sense of how things could be a little different, they wanted things to be a lot different. And I think that that's something that you're going to see on a global scale. And I think that you have seen it to some extent in the United States. You know, during World War II, you saw huge numbers of women enter the workforce, the classic Rosie the Riveter stuff. And then when the guys, the GIs came back home from the war, those women were once again booted out of the economy. They were forced to take subordinate positions. But people didn't forget that. Daughters didn't forget that. And they kept that memory with them. And then through the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of anger that built up. And then finally, you saw the feminist revolution happen. So I think that that's the way you need to think about it sometimes. You know, there's going to be a long historical process. But women, once they get a shot at being equal partners, they're not going to give it up easily.
And of course, all of that took place after our last really great economic crisis, the Great Depression, during which the real effort to get Americans working again was in fact about getting men working again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a really fascinating thing to look at the first half of the 20th century in terms of the lessons it might give us in the first half of the 21st century. For example, throughout the 20s, you saw a huge increase in the number of women working. But then during the Depression, it was this really interesting situation where having your spouse, having your mother work was seen as this terrible thing. It was seen as a sign of extreme deprivation. And so a lot of those folks who grew up then thought, you know, I really want to be able to support the women in my family so that they don't have to work in the market economy. They'll instead work in the home. And so there was this tremendous cultural prestige associated having, you know, with women working in the home. And actually, you know, if you go back to the early United States, women would often take in washing. They would take in boarders. They would provide all kinds of economic services that would bring, you know, money into the family's kitty. But, you know, again, that lost prestige. And so you saw this huge move toward the male breadwinner family. And then, you know, of course, you later saw a backlash against that when it was no longer economically viable.
Well, it's interesting, Rehan. There was a little bit of a surge of that in the late 90s and early 2000s. You had this idea of women opting out of the workforce, and it did become, at least for the middle class and upper middle class, a status symbol once again to have mom at home and dad out earning the bread. Do you think that's sort of gone forever from our culture?
I don't think it's really sustainable, but here's the interesting thing about that phenomenon. So you did have a handful of pretty affluent women opting out because, again, you know, even though they had tremendous earning power, they thought, I could take the hit, we can afford it, and we want to spend more time with our children, which is, you know, very admirable. But the thing is, that only works because you have other women, usually immigrant women, who are then working. So you have this funny phenomenon where you had, you know, middle-class, native-born women who are leaving the workforce, but instead, you know, because in order for them to be in the workforce, you would need to have immigrant women not look after their own children, but look after someone else's children for pay. So, I mean, there's a complicated relationship here, and it affects kind of women any way you slice it.
You write about the fact that unemployment seems to hurt men more sort of mentally than it hurts women. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting phenomenon. Basically, you know, the economy has gone through a lot of changes. People don't expect the same kind of job stability that they expected, say, 20, 30 years ago. There's an expectation that, particularly when you're younger, you're going to change jobs from time to time. And now you have a lot of folks who are middle-aged who know that they're going to have to do that, whether they like it or not. And the thing is that women have always had that experience. They've always had to be resilient, particularly women who are raising children, because, you know, after you have a kid, you know, by necessity, you need to take some time out from the workforce. And then you come back only when, you know, you come back when you can, but there has to be some gap in time. And so now everyone is going to have that resiliency that women have built in.
Rehan Salam is my guest. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation with a new article in the current Foreign Policy magazine called The Death of Macho. We'll return to the conversation in a moment and would love to hear what you have to say. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a fellow at the New America Foundation, Rehan Salam. His article in the new issue of Foreign Policy magazine is called The Death of Macho. It's about the impact of the current recession on men as opposed to women. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org. You already referenced earlier, Rehan, the fact that women in places like Iran are taking on a greater role in public life. You've also observed some really interesting things that are taking place right now in electoral politics in certain parts of the world in response to the crisis.
Yeah, I mean, you've only seen it happen in a handful of countries like Iceland and Latvia, where women have become prime minister, and you've seen this dramatic shift in the composition of the cabinets of the top level of government. But you do see, I think, as a general consequence of rising female rates of educational attainment, more women in leadership roles in countries where they've tended to be excluded. So I think we're going to see more of that, and that's really a product of a long-term trend. One thing that's worth asking is whether or not we're going to see something happen very quickly. Because, you know, sometimes when you're looking at political change, you don't see it happen in a slow and steady trickle. You see it happen overnight. After Watergate, for example, there was a huge turnover in the composition of Congress, and you saw lots of people from the baby boom generation, young, scrappy types. Also, you saw lots of people from ethnic minorities get elected to Congress for the first time. That didn't happen slowly. It happened all in one fell swoop. So could you have a situation like that again where, say, in 5-10 years' time, you suddenly see a huge increase in the number of women? I wouldn't be surprised.
Do you see any evidence that women have an interest in sort of subordinating men in a way that would reflect the way that women had been kept down for centuries in previous history?
I think that's fantasy land. I don't think that that is going to happen, because I think that actually women are going to be busy trying to keep men from collapsing entirely in economic terms. I think that's going to be the real danger, that you're going to see such dislocation, such anger, and such economic failure among men that it's just going to generate huge social problems. So when you have women in leadership roles, they're not going to have any interest in keeping men down. They're going to do whatever they can to see to it that they can get ahead.
If women are more fully employed now, at least those who want to be working, do you think that this could threaten the special protections and special provisions that are made to favor, for example, women-owned businesses and government contracting?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, and I think the answer is probably no. And I think the answer is probably no for a bad reason, which is that once you put something like that in place, it hardly ever goes away. For example, in countries like Malaysia and South Africa, you have programs that are designed to benefit the majority population. And these programs have tended to be fairly poorly designed. So in South Africa, for example, rather than helping the native black majority of the population, it's helped only the small elite. But because it claims to be helping everyone, you know, it's very hard to overturn something like that. So even when proposals like that don't make as much sense, it's very hard to get rid of them. Now, I think that there was a strong case for aiding women, female-owned businesses. And I think that actually, even now you don't see enough female-owned businesses. So I think that those programs are going to remain in place. But even in a world wherein you saw far more, I think you'd be hard-pressed to get rid of them because, you know, again, that would be a world in which more females are in leadership positions. And why would they want to get rid of something that might give them a leg up?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Rehan Salam. Let's go to Bruce in Fort Worth. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
I've got two questions. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The first is whether there is success difference in education among boys and girls in terms of standardized testing. And the second question is whether or not there's a success difference in education among boys that have stay-at-home moms versus women that work, moms that work.
Did
I'll
you
keep my answer up here.
Thanks for your call. Did you look at those things, Rehan?
I'm sorry, I didn't actually hear the question all that well. Do you mind repeating it for me for a second?
Yeah, first he was asking about whether or not there's a difference in standardized testing in terms of how boys score as compared with girls, and then whether there's a difference with how boys do, or in particular if they have stay-at-home moms as opposed to moms who are out in the workforce.
Well, with regard to the first question, the answer is definitely yes. There's a very wide gap that's opened up, and it's not only in the United States. You see the gap in other Western countries as well. For example, in Britain, on A-level results, women are far outstripping men, or I should say girls are outstripping boys. With regard to that second question, it's very hard to say because you have a lot of so-called confounding variables at work. When you're comparing the population of, you know, folks who have stay-at-home moms to those who don't, you're not really dealing with comparable populations. As you were suggesting earlier on, you know, you have to have the economic wherewithal to not have two spouses working. So that means there are going to be other differences as well. You know, those families might be more affluent, or they might be more religious, or they might live in different parts of the country. They might come from different ethnic backgrounds. So you can't really make an apples-to-apples comparison, unfortunately.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Joe in Dallas. Hey, Joe.
Hi, yeah, this is Joe from Dallas. In the work at New York University years ago, and worked in political philosophy, there was a course in which they outlined that the chief goal of society must be its stability, because it's characteristic of the breakup of societies is the breakup of stability. So the question is, we look at the elements. What are the causes of destabilizing, and I guess the primary cause is the breakup of the family, which leads to dropouts, teen crime, teen pregnancy, and gangs, and that whole list. And further, the goal of society must be the preparation of children for citizenship, and I don't hear that much discussed. Have you ever done any work in these areas in your research? Go ahead.
Thanks for your call.
I think that's a terrific question, and I think that, you know, I personally am sympathetic to that view. I think that when you're looking at a country like China, where you have such intense discrimination against women and girls that people have tended toward illegally aborting female fetuses, you have a really dire situation where there's actually a shortage of girls. The shortage is so severe that China is actually now backing away from its one-child policy. And this shortage means that you're going to have large numbers, upwards of tens of millions, of young Chinese men who are never going to be able to find spouses. And when you have such a huge number of unmarriageable men, you oftentimes throughout history have seen periods where you have networked, coordinated violence. Because, you know, it really is true that marriage has a strong civilizing force, as you say. Now, with regard to child rearing, I mean, this is, you know, controversial stuff. Not everyone agrees about this. But I think that, you know, when you look at the beginning of the 20th century, a large majority of American households had a child under the age of 18. Now it's a small minority that does. And I think that has all kinds of effects on society. You know, for one thing, raising children is something that teaches people a level of restraint. And that's something that affects how you look at the world in a lot of, you know, broad ways. I don't have children myself, and I think that, you know, plenty of, you know, very, you know, good, admirable people don't raise children and, you know, don't intend to. But I do think that it does change your way of approaching the world, and I think that it changes the texture of society when only a minority of people ever have that experience.
And you've also found that even in countries where the male-to-female ratio is pretty even, young men who aren't finding gainful employment are not thinking that marriage is an option for them.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you have young women who don't think that men who have particularly bright economic prospects are good partners for them, too. I mean, one dynamic that people often refer to, and again, this is another thing that, you know, plenty of smart people disagree about, is that, you know, women have traditionally looked to men of higher status than themselves, meaning, you know, I want to marry up rather than to marry down. You know, you want to marry someone who, you know, is your equal in many respects, but who can pick up the economic slack if you want to leave the work for some period of time to raise children, for example. And so that's why it's a very interesting situation we're in, where you have women with these higher rates of educational attainment and men with lower rates of educational attainment, because it means that, you know, mathematically speaking, you're just going to have this imbalance emerge. You already see that among African Americans, and now you're going to see it with the broader population as well. And that is going to change the way that we approach marriage and relationships by necessity.
Are marriages having a harder time staying together in the current climate?
Well, there's an interesting effect. In the early stages of a severe economic downturn, you see a kind of hunkering down. You see people decide, you know what, we'll put aside our disagreements and we're going to pull together so that we can make it through this, you know, these bad economic circumstances. But then when a downturn like this persists for a longer period of time, it just builds up tremendous stress in a marriage that could then end in marital dissolution. So it's hard to say either way, but I think that, you know, it certainly does build up a lot of stress. And the other thing is that, you know, you see higher rates of divorce when, you know, women feel that they have more in the way of earning power and thus have options outside of the marriage. And, you know, that's actually one thing that you've seen driving the housing boom. It's been family breakdown. When you have intact families, you obviously need fewer houses and apartments. And when you have huge amounts of family breakdown, you know, you need to build more houses so that you can have more of these, you know, smaller households. So I think that, you know, that's what you're likely to see in the short term, maybe a little bit less in the way of marital breakdown. In the longer term, you'll see more.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Landon in Fort Worth who asks, are employers recognizing a need to share child-rearing responsibility, or do they tend to assume still that the mother will bear the burden?
I think that employers are basically responding to what their employees demand. And I think that, you know, the real change that has to happen has to be a deeper cultural change so that, you know, men take up more of that burden. In lots of countries in Northern Europe, you see policies that have been designed to encourage more gender equity, more sharing of the child-rearing burden. But the thing is that, you know, you have this funny effect. In Sweden, for example, both mothers and fathers have to take some parental leave if you're going to get, you know, the higher amount of parental leave. And it turns out that fathers tend to take their leave during major sporting events. They tend to take it at the beginning or end of vacations they already had scheduled so as to make them a bit longer. And it seems that they're not concentrating quite as much on the child-rearing duties per se. Or when you're looking at academics, you know, American colleges and universities tend to have very generous policies for paternal leave as well as maternity leave, but it, you know, there have been studies that have found that men use that paternity leave to write papers that help them get tenured, that help them get jobs, whereas women tend to use their maternity leave to actually raise their children. So I think that, you know, you still have this kind of cultural attitude that makes it hard to kind of split those responsibilities evenly. But with regard to employers, I think that, you know, you do see it in some areas where, again, you know, you have the employees demanding it. And I do think you've seen this broader shift with men, particularly college-educated men, wherein they spend a lot more time doting on and talking about their children. Being fathers is a more important part of their identity than it would have been, say, 30, 40 years ago.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Rehan Salam, who's written an article called The Death of Macho for the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine. Let's go next to Bedford, where we'll speak with Jose. Hi, Jose.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Well, my question to your guest, since the title of the book is in that area, is the general feminization of men worldwide contributing to this, I can call it problem, because the lack of father figure, strong father figure image on young men lives in this country is producing a very catastrophic effect in the future of families that will be formed with no idea what the father role really should be. And those boys never really get to see a strong father figure that they can emulate, copy, or look at to, or become. So what would those people think about this feminization of society and the world and our own country here with the lack of a paternal figure altogether?
I think that's extremely, extremely important. I think that that is an underlying issue behind a lot of the increase in inequality and instability in family life. So I agree with you there. But on the other hand, I'll also say that I think the lack of father figures doesn't necessarily encourage feminization of men. I think it actually can incur masculinization of men. You know, if you're looking at American inner cities where you've seen the death of macho happened a long time ago, where you see a lot of those father figures wind up behind bars, you see their economic prospects having to decline catastrophically, and they tend not to participate in the rearing of children. You see a situation where boys actually feel like they have to be tougher, they have to be more aggressive, they have to prove themselves in that way because they don't have father figures to show them that there's another way of, you know, being a man. And so I think that that's one of these kind of funny effects. I mean, if you actually did have, you know, fewer fatherless families, you might see men adapt more successfully to this new economic environment.
Let's go next to Denton, where we'll speak with Jennifer. Hey, Jennifer.
Yes, hello.
Hi. Go ahead,
sorry
please.
About the reception here. Let me see if I can find a little bit better place to be.
Sounds like you're in an echo chamber.
Are you able to hear me now?
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay, great. Yes, my question to the interviewee is how familiar is he, and maybe even yourself as well, with the early years of the women's movement from Seneca Falls in 1848 and forward? And just because when I tuned into the show, I heard a description of what of the back and forth in terms of women in the workplace and so on and so forth that struck me as somewhat short in terms of information about what really had gone on, and that this was a long-term, painstaking effort and not reactionary, shall we say.
Okay, well, that wasn't the subject of the conversation, but I'm happy to talk about it. I mean, I think that you see an incredibly long history that I don't think has a single narrative thread. For example, one of the funnier aspects of the history of American feminism is that when you look at the New Deal period, if you look at women like Julia Lathrop, if you look at the so-called maternalists who played a very active role in framing the New Deal, these were women who were highly educated. They tended to be social scientists, social workers, and though they were professional women themselves, they actually believed that having more women in the workforce was a bad thing. I think that now we would disagree with them pretty strongly. But, I mean, it's a kind of funny phenomenon that had lots of twists and turns.
Rehan Salam is my guest. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation with an article in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine called The Death of Macho. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about an article in Foreign Policy magazine for July and August called The Death of Macho. My guest is its author, Rehan Salam, who is also a fellow at the New America Foundation. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Matt in Arlington. Hello, Matt.
Hello. Yes, I just really had a comment for your guest. Given the, you know, previous couple decades of increased feminization of modern men and every, you know, thing that we were supposed to have been embracing with this, you know, idea of compassion and sensitivity, there seems to be a blowback from women on that now, where they're now preferring more masculine men. And they're also, because men have suppressed or stifled that inherent, you know, male masculinity for so long, there seems to be a blowback in men towards this more aggressive masculine kind of behavior. And if anything, I think it's bad for a modern society to have this prevalence of macho behavior, because it's more of a base kind of, you know, aggressive reaction. But if anything, I actually more of this macho behavior continuing, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Well, you write in the piece, Rehan, that men basically have two choices. They can either acquiesce to this or they can resist against it. And that sounds as if that's what our caller was talking about.
Yeah, that's a really smart point. I think that when, again, it goes back to that point about having the substance of power and just having the assertion of power. When you're talking about male dominance and it rests on the fact that, you know, men are bringing home the bacon, quote unquote, then, you know, there's a logic to it, even though it's not a good thing. And actually, the reason why we moved away from that world is because we weren't really drawing on the talents of half of the population, which is crazy. It's just inefficient, if not also immoral. But then, you know, you have the situation where men come to expect that despite the fact that they no longer really provide the bulk of the wealth in a society. And so then you just have a lot of posturing that happens. And a lot of that posturing takes the form of, you know, it can take the form of violence. It can take the more form of all kinds of kind of nihilistic rejections of mainstream culture. And I think that's the danger that you see in societies that have done a worse job than we have of accommodating the rise of women and seeing to it that, you know, men have better role models for how to adapt to this new set of circumstances.
I wonder sometimes when we talk about the masculinization of women and the feminization of men, if what we're really talking about here is everybody relaxing more into what their natural roles might have been without society deciding that there was one way to be male and one way to be female.
Yeah, I think that's a hard question to answer because I think that, you know, those societal expectations are very powerful, and I'm not sure if you do have some kind of natural way to be in the absence of them. So I wouldn't really be able to answer that for you, I'm afraid.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Edward in Allen. Hey, Edward.
Hi, how you doing today?
Great, thank you.
Well, I just wanted to say, just as a comment first, is one of the ways I was raised to be a man in today's culture was not one of dominance, but one of humility. One in which I put myself behind my family unit and indeed my country. But I wonder, as grateful as I am to the consciousness raising of the feminist movement, have we talked so much about equal rights that we forgot to talk about equal responsibility? And one example I put out there is not only are men expected a lot by society to pay for things, but we are also the only one that will face the draft, which is a horrible prospect. But as a man, we don't really complain about it all that much. And I will take my comment off there, and thank you.
Thanks for your call.
That is interesting. I think that, you know, it's true that you still have selective service. You know, we haven't seen real conscription for, you know, many decades now. And I wonder if, you know, we ever did see a return of conscription, if there actually would be some call for women to also provide some kind of national service, say on the home front or maybe even in combat roles. I wouldn't rule it out because, you know, society is changing pretty quickly. And when you're looking at the military's recruitment needs, it's interesting because, you know, there are only about 600,000 men who come of age for military service every year, and the military tends to draw about a sixth of that. That's really quite high. And so, you know, finding enough men who meet the standards of fitness, who meet the standards in terms of meeting the educational requirements, it's actually quite tough. So, you know, you can easily imagine a future in which the military decides they need to actually broaden that pool beyond what we have now. And so maybe we will have women drafted.
Let's go next on the phone to Louisville, where we'll speak with Brett. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Chris. I got to tell you, I am like the poster child of this. I was actually raised by a single mother, very strong-willed, with a master's in science and math. I am now married to my wife, who, you know, when we married, was actually in college has finished college and has now surpassed me in her education with a master's. And I used to make significantly more than she did, and now she's actually making more than I did, but I can't afford to go back to school because now I'm saving to help get our daughter into college when she gets older. So I'm just sitting here cracking up as I'm listening to this. I think it's just a great conversation. And I am in full support of strong women in the world.
Thank you very much for your call. I don't think you'll have any arguments there. It seems, Brown, that there are a lot more men out there like Brett these days who are at least comfortable with the idea that, they don't have to sort of prove themselves as men by, being the primary breadwinners.
Yeah, I think that that's true, and I think you're going to see more of that over time because, you know, again, it's just the nature of female educational attainment going where it is that that's just going to become a lot more conventional.
Are there things we need to worry about in terms of our sons collectively growing up in this new world order?
Yeah, I think that it's really important to destigmatize academic achievement. One of these people always talk about how when you're looking at young African American kids, they often think of doing well academically as acting white. But you know, it's interesting because you have this new phenomenon where for a lot of boys, it's actually about acting female to do well in school. And I think that that's just a really, really dangerous attitude. So I think that that's something that you want to keep tabs on. And I also think that, on the other hand, there are lots of ways in which, men are distinctive in a way that's actually pretty valuable and that we want to preserve. So, you have lots of men who traditionally gravitated towards skilled professions, toward the trades. And I think that those professions have lost a lot of respect over the last couple of decades. And I think that that's overall been pretty destructive. I think that, restoring some of the esteem for that kind of work might actually be a way of seeing to it that men actually, continue to take part in the formal economy and flourish.
Let's go next to Marshall in Dallas. Hello, Marshall.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yes. I have one comment and one question. One is I was reading a 19th century author some years ago, and he made the comment that European men thought that American men in the 19th century were much too weak or not strong enough in terms of American women. And I thought my own reaction to that is that American women, because of the experience of the frontier, naturally became strong, and so American men naturally wanted strong women. But my question is this. I noticed there are many more black women with university degrees and postgraduate degrees than black men. What the social effects of this now and in the future is bound to be momentous. I wonder if you have any comment about that.
Yeah, I think that it is, and I think that you've already seen lots of complicated effects from the fact that there's this big gap in terms of the earning power of African American women and men. And I think that, what we're looking at now is the possibility that this might spread beyond that community to the wider community as you see a similar gap open up, between women and men overall.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Jay in Dallas. Hey, Jay.
Hi, this is Joyce. And,
oh, Joyce, I'm sorry.
I am that black woman that you guys are talking about. I was in corporate America in the early 70s in a man's job, computer programmer, and I could program in 5 languages, and I ended my corporate career as the number one salesperson for a huge high-tech company. So I managed my career extremely well, outranked and out-earned my husband, who had 2 degrees when I had a 2-year degree. I'm one of those strong black women. So let me talk to you about being the mother of 2 high-achieving black men and what I expected out of my children as men was to be the strongest Americans they could be, take full advantage of what I didn't have the rights to until I was 14 in this country. And that's the ability to go to any school or even go to some place to have a nice meal until I was 14 years old. And I'm still a high-achieving woman with a global company that I've created now. So I want to tell all of the folks who are worried about our men don't worry about it. We as women are trying to encourage our men, and we're finding great results.
Well, let me
ask
you.
What I'm finding in America is that we have decided to be less, and we start with doing less raising, well raising, good, strong raising of our children, and expecting parents. I think there needs to be adult peer pressure where whether you're working mothers, working husbands, working whatever, that we raise the best children. I'm so disgusted that everybody's trying to find themselves and work on their feelings instead of going for results.
Joyce, very quickly, because we're almost out of time, but I want to ask you very quickly if you could talk about, was there a difference in the way you talked to your sons about what you expected from them and the way your husband communicated what he expected from them?
We agreed on what we were going to do. And in so many ways, my children, even though I was a high-achieving mother, saw me as the woman who put on her slippers and put on her apron and made them lasagna or gumbo, right? Because I'm the mother.
Bring home the bacon and fry it up in the pan.
Well, it wasn't just that. They expected me to be more the mother. With their father, he took over when they became older, more of the discipline and the talking to them. And the discipline had to do with, you know, do you understand this is what we expect instead of any kind of hitting or anything. But we let them know the plan was to raise them to be intelligent and to leave our house for good.
Well, sounds like, based on your description, that it worked out beautifully. So I do appreciate your call, Joyce. Brian, is there any putting Pandora back, closing Pandora's box again? Is this something that is a phenomenon that's going to last, or will the turnaround in the economy, whenever it comes, sort of put some of this away?
I think that the economic downturn has only accelerated trends that were already in place. So I don't think that there's any going back, and I think that that's mostly a good thing. I think that the key issue is whether men can catch up now that women have surpassed them.
Do men need help to catch up?
I think that it really is the kind of thing that you can't expect the government to do. It has to come from slow and steady cultural change. And any efforts to speed that up, to short-circuit it, to interfere, are probably going to backfire. So better to actually have it happen through parents, like the last caller, and through schools, rather than through some kind of grand plan.
Any question whatsoever that we will all be better off, men, women, and children, when we are fully equal, at least in terms of gender?
Well, I don't think that, full equality, it's hard to say exactly what that's going to look like because, you know, when you actually get to a situation where people are sufficiently relaxed, you're actually not going to, you know, bean count. You know what I mean? It's going to be okay if, say, Congress is 60-40 female-male, if that just reflects the fact that, you know, women prefer being politicians or something along those lines. When there really is a situation with genuinely equal opportunities, we're not going to fret as much because we're going to know that if a woman wants to do X or Y, she's going to have the opportunity to do so. So I think that, you know, are you going to have full equality understood as numerical equality? I think that's unlikely because, you know, different people have different proclivities.
Rehan Salam is a fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of an article called The Death of Macho, which is in the July-August issue of Foreign Policy magazine. Rehan, thank you so much. It was a great discussion.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.